You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
It's an American life that dislocated whiteness from its presumed position of centrality and normality, made it subjective, made you have to consider the entire history and legacy of white co-option of black culture.
Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This week, we have an interview with author Adam Mansbach, and we also have two special guests, DJ J Period and Dresden Dolls drummer Brian Viglione. Mansbach is best known as the author of the satirical children's book Go the Fuck to Sleep. On top of him being a frequent Rap Genius user, you have to check out his verified account, his novels deal with some of the thorniest issues in American life. The relationship between jazz and hip-hop and race, what writers owe to their work and to the people in their lives, and the universal timeless conflicts between parents and children. In addition to being a great writer, Mansbach was also for 6 years the drum tech for the Elvin Jones Jazz Machine. Jones was famously John Coltrane's drummer in the 1960s and a powerhouse and influential drummer until his death. J Period is a well-known mixtape DJ. He's put together tapes with such artists as Black Thought and Nas, and he's currently the DJ for the Brooklyn Nets. The reason he's joining us today is he put together the mixtape that goes along with Mansbach's latest novel, Rage Is Back. Our final guest, Brian Viglione of the Dresden Dolls, in addition to being a longtime friend of mine and one of the best drummers in rock and roll, is also a lifelong Elvin Jones fan. So I invited him along to contribute to the portion of our conversation with Mansbach about his work with Elvin. And as always, we have annotated interview excerpts. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius.
Go to rapgenius.com and search for Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. The very first result will bring you annotated interview excerpts. Extra audio, video, and information to bring you further outside the lines. And now, here's my conversation with Adam Mansbach with special guests J Period and Brian Viglione. Same Old Sean here with Adam Mansbach, J Period, and sitting in the corner here
for
quietly
moral
for moral support is Brian Viglione of the Dresden Dolls.
Yes.
Yeah. So, hey, everybody. I guess I just wanted to start first with Jay about the tape, or you guys both made a mixtape to support the book, right? So, can you tell me a little bit about like the collaboration process on the tape? Basically, like, how'd you keep the stuff on, you know, within the themes of the tape, right? Assuming you can't say, you weren't saying like, hey, come and rap about this.
Right. How did I keep it within the themes of the
tape?
I think one of the things I do as a mixtape DJ in all my projects, because all my mixtapes are kind of part documentary, part mixtape, is really try and track down bits and pieces that are applicable to different sorts of things. And then when a project comes along like this, I have things, some things already sitting there kind of ready to go. And then as far as the structure of the whole tape, you know, Adam and I have been talking since, maybe like 6 months going on now, about this idea of a mixtape to promote the book, and then pushing that even further, like making a mixtape into a book almost. And, you know, when I was a kid, I had these sort of book and record sets. And so I used that as a kind of inspiration, I guess, for the structure of the tape. Mm-hmm. And then the songs themselves, you know, I think that one of the themes in hip hop is, you know, in the hip hop I love is the preservation of hip hop. And so when, you know, it came for this, you know, which felt like it's about, you know, the vibe and era of you know, late 80s, early 90s in New York, and that brand of hip hop, I sort of sought out things that were like that, or took things, you know, some of the tape is existing tracks that I flipped and remixed, but it might be a specific verse. So like it's, you know, Nas's third verse of One Love where he's telling that story, and that'll be the verse that I flip over another beat. You know, with regards to the new stuff, you know, really, I think, again, it's more about the artist than about me telling them what to say. So if you have Common in the studio, you know, I'm already going to be like, I want Common, you know, I want like that, you know, that real raw, gritty, you know, Common. And what he came with was this, you know, sort of sequel to I Used to Love Her, which obviously, you know, as any fan of hip hop, you know, that was tremendous and epic. And so it just was, part of it is just fortunate, you know, but there's definitely thought behind it. I mean, we had in our minds what this was going to be before it sort of came to fruition.
One other thing about, on a lot of your tapes, you do a lot of blends, right? And I was curious about this, like when you're doing a blend, is there in your mind, like, does there have to be a connection between the verse you use and the beat you use?
It's not always between verse and beat or verse and verse. There just has to be some kind of connection or correlation. Sometimes what I'll do, like in the more intricate transitions, like on the Q-Tip mixtape, for example, it's Q-Tip talking about how, you know, Award Tour was inspired by Jade, Don't Walk Away. And then I take him sort of like singing the bass line of Jade, Don't Walk Away, literally extract that, make that a loop behind what he's saying. And then he talks about the Weldon Irving sample, and then take the Weldon Irving sample and lay that over the top of it and make it part of the beat. So I'm sort of constructing what he's talking about while he's talking about it. And then it kind of melts into Award Tour. So it can be that level of intricacy, or it can just be, you know, like thematic. I mean, my stuff is really thematic. So, you know, it might be a sample from one thing flipping into another thing. I like to do that a lot, is really tell the story of where the song came from. So if I'm going to play, you know, such and such song, or I, for example, on the tape again, One Love, I took the original Smiling Billy Sweet and made a beat out of that, you know, and just let it play long form, which I, you know, he commented on, I was like, you know, that was dope, you know, and these things kind of make sense, but for some reason, nobody's ever done that before. So it's like, really, that's kind of the way I approach it.
Awesome. Rap Bees.
And Adam, first of all, good to meet you.
Good to meet you. Good to be here.
You just published Rage Is Back, obviously, but I wanted to kind of start by talking about your work in general, right? You have your characters who in different books show up in different books, but they even have different life stories, right? Like Van Horn, Albert Van Horn, who's your kind of Coltrane, Elvin Jones-ish hybrid character, dies two different ways, right? In one, it's kind of this mysterious, maybe mob hit type thing, and in the other it's of natural causes.
Right.
Rage, your central character in Rage Is Back, is in fact two different people.
He is?
Right. Isn't it End of Jews? He's the fictional, he's Risk's alter ego.
Nah.
No?
That one, or, not so much.
No?
I don't believe so. You could be right, though. I mean, yeah, a lot of this shit is due to total inconsistency on my part.
Yeah.
It's not like there was a grand plan for Albert Van Horn to die two different ways.
Yeah.
I like the idea of transitioning characters from one book to another and having crossover and overlap. It's probably a kind of Kurt Vonnegut hangover from my teenage years. But yeah, it's sometimes premeditated, and sometimes I just hope that no one has actually read all those books and will make those connections. So thanks for putting that on blast, Sean. I appreciate that.
Happy to do it. I was going to ask, I mean, maybe if it's not that conscious, it reminded me of like the concept of like he was talking about of like remixing something.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, the concept of remixing I'm certainly drawn to as a writer. And I think a lot of the sensibility that runs through my books and connects them to each other in ways that might be less obvious have to do with that kind of hip hop mixology sensibility. The notion of a novel as a mix board where you can bring the faders up and down on things like plot and character and the notion of sampling even. I feel like there are a lot of samples laced into the fabric of the books I write. And certainly the idea of remixing for me has to do with perspective. Sometimes in Rage Is Back, you see an incident play out, for instance, in Cloud Nine's perspective, the one chapter that he narrates, and then you see it questioned and doubted and different versions offered of what might have gone down from different characters. And even to pull back the camera and talk about that on a larger scale, the bedrock events of Billy Rage's life are subject to sort of communal speculation. His son Dondi, who narrates the book, has been collecting versions and different mixes, so to speak, of what happened for his entire existence, you know? So I do think about those things, and I think about what it means to translate a hip-hop sensibility onto the page in that way and in other ways. But sometimes I have these characters that I want to keep working with, and the facts as I've laid them down are too rigid, so I have to stretch things or just say, fuck it, that was that book, this is the next book. Sometimes it lines up. Increasingly, as I go on, I'm making an effort to make it line up. Cloud Nine lines up better with The End of the Jews and Rage Is Back than Albert Van Horn does, clearly, as you've noticed. I mean, there's a 10-year or a 12-year gap between those books. I'm afraid to even go back and read my first novel featuring Albert Van Horn, because the shit, I wrote it when I was like 20. There's definitely too many adverbs in it. I don't know what else is wrong with it, but like, you know.
Nice. All right. Well, maybe we can reissue it and take out some of the LYs.
Yeah. Maybe 20th anniversary.
I'm gonna have to go back. I didn't realize you're sampling little bits of things in different places. That's
like, yeah.
There's some of that.
It's very crate digger mentality. Yeah. In the back of your mind.
You got to make the most of it. You know.
Yeah. Speaking of samples and recontextualizing, right? You'll often have like insert fictional characters into real life art histories, right? Albert Van Horn into kind of like 60s, you know, almost, you know, bordering on free, becoming free jazz. Dengue into graffiti. Like, what does that allow you to do that, say, like, writing an article about Ramelsey or about Coltrane or something wouldn't?
Well, I mean, I insert these fictional characters because I need the freedom to do what it is I'm trying to do. I need to be able to tell the story the way that it's organic to the points I want to make, the characters I want to sculpt. But I want to situate everybody within a real life context, because to me that's usually more interesting than whatever elaborate fiction I might construct in terms of a framework. And also because in a lot of the stories I'm telling, it's important to me to actually elaborate on and put down the lore and the history and the real life events that shaped the characters that I'm inventing. It's in the world of graffiti particularly. I mean, this is a culture in which most of the great art that was produced was eradicated. You know, it's an incredibly spotty record. Nothing exists physically, and the photography of the period, is doesn't even capture 5% of what was painted on those trains. So it's become a kind of oral tradition of handing down what did happen. And so I want to draw on that, elaborate on it, get it into print, riff on it. And for the most part, I'm going to have more fun and actually feel more of a sense of freedom working within those parameters than I would inventing some shit out of whole cloth.
Right.
And also, if I'm writing about graffiti, I feel responsible to and compelled by the people who lived it, and I want to do right by them. So I want to get the facts right, I want to get the context right, and I want to shed light on the policies and the circumstances that led John Lindsay to declare war on graffiti in 1972 and a succession of mayors to spend $300 million trying to fight it over the next 18 years. And I want to be able to make the connections between that war and the current state of personal freedom and youth culture in this country. And the truth is that that war ideologically ushered in things like zero tolerance policy, quality of life offenses, the epic racial profiling that we now call gang database, information, you know, all this kind of stuff. So it behooves me much more to stick within the framework and insert my characters into it, but keep everything else as close to reality as I can.
Okay. And you mentioned the people who really did graffiti. One of them did the cover of your book, possibly the world's first white rapper.
Blake Lethem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keo. Yeah. TC5. Scotch 79. Shout out to him.
Nice.
He did the cover. He did the cover of the mixtape. He did the illuminated letters inside the book. And he was, you know, a valuable source for me when I was writing the book, as were a lot of other writers, from Part One to Phase Two to Zephyr to Alan Kett to Bomb Five. I mean, I couldn't have written the book without the access that I had to these guys, not just in the writing process, but over the last 20 years.
Rap Genius.
Well, so if I can ask, what's your personal history with graffiti?
I was a really good lookout. You know, there's always different iterations of what hip hop is supposed to be and what you are supposed to do as a participant in it. And when I was coming up in it and where I was coming up in it, the idea that was presented to us was that it was this holistic all of a piece thing. And if you wanted to be hip hop, you had to be proficient in at least two art forms and hopefully three. So you had to be more than just an MC. You also had to be nice with the, you know, with the can or behind the ones and twos, or you had to be able to dance, or you had to be able to beatbox or whatever. So my primary thing was always MCing, but I could also DJ and I could try to write graffiti. You know, the spirit was willing. The hand styles were kind of weak.
Right, right.
And what was your name?
I wrote Easel. I wrote Just, which was short for Justice.
Well, Easel's from one of your books, right? Didn't you?
Yeah, I think I did. You're better than me. I forget where and when, but yeah, I think somebody does write Easel in one of my books.
It's an angry black white boy or something.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. Macon Day Tournay, the title character of Angry Black White Boy, or the miscegenation of Macon Day Tournay, does write Easel. You're absolutely right. Yeah. Script was another alias of mine, which ends up being Cloud Nine's nephew in The End of the Jews, writes Script. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a couple, you know, arrests to show for my graffiti career, but not really that much great art. But I mean, I learned pretty quickly that graffiti writers were fascinating people. You know, they were the eccentrics, the weirdos, the stepchildren in some ways of hip hop culture. They were the ones who were theorists more than anybody else. Like, you know, Jay can probably talk about this better than me, but I think it's often really hard to get, say, an MC to theorize about what he or she does. They do what they do. They do it impeccably well. But I've sat down with some of the greats, Pharoah Monch or OC, Jay, you know, like, and getting cats to talk about how they do their craft is harder than getting them to spit a hot 16. But graffiti writers are nothing if not theorists and weirdos. And, you know, so I think my appetite for hanging out with them just increased with exposure. When I moved to New York in 94 and I started running a hip hop magazine in 95, you know, I just like put in as many hours as I could with guys like Phase Two and Bomb Five, because they were just repositories of history and theory and beef.
in the acknowledgments of End of the Jews and other places, you know, well, in that particular, you thank Alvin Jones, and I know you and his wife, and I know you teched for him for a long time. We were talking about it beforehand. Can you talk just a little bit about knowing him and getting to see him play so frequently, kind of night after night, as opposed to, you know, just a couple times?
Yeah, I think for me it was a formative and an incredibly powerful ongoing experience. I started to go out on the road with Elvin in 97. So I was in college. And I got the job because I knew Delfeo Marsalis, trombone player who was in and out of the band a lot and a good friend of the family. And also I was able to triangulate that connection with another one, which was a guy named Craig Levine, who had sort of at one point been a drum tech for Elvin and then grew up and became an attorney and was almost like the family consigliere. And he vetted people. And I knew him through a guy that I knew that was a teacher at my high school back in the day, Andre C. Willis, who's still one of my best friends. I've known him since I was 14, and in many, many ways would not be doing any of the things I'm doing if not for having met him at that point. So I got the job with Elvin in 97. and began to travel with him domestically and abroad, a lot of European tours in the summer times, that kind of thing. And I was 20 when I first got the gig, and I was working on my first novel. I was working on Shackling Water, which is a novel set in the world of jazz. Traveling with Elvin and getting to know him and his wife and manager Keiko and the various people who came in and out of that band was really astonishing for me. I'd been around jazz before through Andre Willis. I'd gotten to know the Marsalis family and that extended circle of musicians. You know, I'd in high school go up and hang out with his septet and stuff like that. I remember watching the Tyson Holyfield fight with them in a hotel room, and just, I was like 15. I was like, how the fuck am I in this room? You know, you know, Elvin was a guy who, when I met him, was in his late 60s and just a titan in his field. I mean, if Elvin Jones is not the greatest drummer produced on this planet, I don't know who is. I got into a fight with Sonia Sanchez about this last week because I said this on stage at a gig we were doing together, and she turned to me. She was like, Max Roach. I was like, oh, we're going to do this now, Sonia Sanchez, really? And, you know, Elvin was a guy who was full of a tremendous light and energy. And he really conveyed a powerful sense of the possibility of music and the healing power of music and the power to express love through music. He wasn't a guy who spoke incessantly. He was kind of not a man of few words, but a man of carefully chosen ones, and a man who didn't speak when a hug would suffice or a smile. He was a guy who practiced 10 hours a day throughout his entire childhood without a set of drums necessarily, you know, and came up at a time when the incredibly overwhelming, pernicious effects of racism on a black man from Pontiac, Michigan are not to be over, you know, cannot be overstated. He's the, you know, he had 10 brothers and sisters, two of whom became famous jazz legends in their own right. And he's a guy whose rigor and whose devotion to his music was a totalizing passion. And he'd been through a lot of rough shit. He'd been through his battles with addiction and had come out on the other side of it in a different kind of place. And he had the love of his wife, Keiko, who sort of took care of every practical detail of his life. I mean, she was his manager. She had gotten him off of drugs back in the day and made it her business to keep him on the straight and narrow. And there was this very funny kind of dynamic sense of play between the two of them. Like Elvin, you know, was not going to fall off any wagons, but he maybe would want one more drink than Keiko was comfortable with him having. You know, he could drink a couple glasses of wine, but she was going to keep an eye on things, or a couple Campari and sodas. And I learned pretty quickly that Elvin had a lot of game. He'd be like, hey, Adam, you want a beer? And I'd be like, no, I'm good, Veen. Well, just hold it for me, you know? And he'd finish his and then take mine and take like a long slug and then hand it back to me. You know, he was a guy who was a joy to be around. And, you know, I was in the band long enough to get to know him and get close to him and even get to hear some of his stories about Coltrane, which he didn't tell very freely because that was probably one of the most incredible musical partnerships the world's ever seen. The connection between those two, between the four of them in the band, him and Elvin and McCoy and Jimmy, was a phenomenal thing. But at the real core of the core of the core was Elvin and John, in my opinion. And, you know, John had been gone for 30 years when I met Elvin, but it was still like a really painful thing. And he had a couple of stock public answers he would give. You know, reporters would ask me, say, well, John was an angel. And he just kind of leave it at that, because I think it was painful for him to go deeper. But he would sort of incidentally tell stories about John. And that was always when I really like paid close attention. You know, we'd be talking about stories about people missing planes or various travel wackiness. And that's when a story about John would come to the forefront and I'd be hearing some shit that was mind blowing. You know, like the time there was a gig in DC and there was a blizzard and McCoy and Jimmy were supposed to be on the second flight, but they missed it. And so only Elvin and John get to the gig and they start playing and like they're expecting the other guys to walk in at any moment, but they just keep not walking in. Next thing they know, they've played a 90 minute set and they take a break and they get back on the stage and they start playing again. And like, you know, Jimmy and McCoy walk in an hour after that and they're still playing and they try to come up on stage and Elvin won't let them. You know, he's like, we got this, like, get a drink, you know. I mean, shit like that, you know. As you can see, I could go on forever about this, so I'm going to shut the fuck up.
Sure.
Now.
Sure. Brian, do you have anything you want to, for the record?
Well, just only to touch on what you had sort of mentioned before is that I think you find people like Elvin who express so much in such depth of experience through their playing that you often wonder too, how do they then at those times then verbally express some of the things that are more difficult mm-hmm. to address in, you know, sort of like public situations and the more intimate side, and with all due respect to someone's private life. I always had wondered about that aspect. And I remember being, you know, 20 years old and at a gig told Keiko on the drummer too, and that was a big inspiration. She said, stay away from drugs. One thing you remember in anything you do in life, stay away from that. And it made me think, I was like, I wonder, because you know, I never really read that much about that sort of thing, but you know people that can express to that capacity, have lived through some hard times, and have a lot to say and get out, and that kind of thing too, and it must have been really amazing to be close to that.
Yeah, and there was a sense of a guy who had come through some shit in a really profound kind of way. And, you know, Keiko, I mean, it's hard to express the level at which Keiko did not and does not fuck around.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, like, I've seen Keiko kick motherfuckers out of the entire club because they were high. Like, not the dressing room, not you can't come up on the stage, but like, get out of here. Don't let me see you in here again.
Yeah.
I'm talking about established, famous musicians. I've seen Keiko fire people in motherfucking Poland. Like, yo, you're gone. Like, you're not in this band anymore. Yeah. Find your way home. You know what I mean? Like,
wow.
I love Keiko. Let me make that clear.
Yeah.
What were the other sort of casual friendships like the sort of day to day people that sort of came in and out of life, and that was it? Was more of a sort of just the band, and that was where it existed, just Ian Keiko, or was there more expansive social situation?
There was definitely an expansive social situation. I mean, there was this... Well, it's funny because, I mean, Elvin and Keiko were on the road more than they were home. And they were more comfortable in some ways on the road than they were at home. Like, Keiko was a genius at turning any hotel room into home. You know, like, she had the things with her that the two of them needed to feel comfortable. Yeah. Whether that was Elvin's robe or the kind of tea they liked to drink, or the knowledge of where you would go for good Japanese food in that city. She knew what hotel she wanted to be at. You know, she got really, really good at making home a concept that was portable. Their actual home in New York was not uncomfortable, but it was like full of equipment. They had two apartments in the same building, one on top of the other. One was just storage for the drums. That's where I would go to like load up all the shit when we went on the road. The other above it, they lived in. And, you know, Elvin would kick it there, but there was almost always, I always had this sense when I visited them there that this was more of a holding pattern than anything else. You know, the road was like where life was really lived. But they had friends in every city. And I mean, on earth, you know what I mean? So there were always people coming to the gigs. It was sometimes, for a casual observer, it would be hard to tell who they were really close to and who they weren't, because Elvin was so effusive.
Yeah.
You know, he might have just met you and he'd still be lifting you off the ground in a bear hug, you know. But there were indicators to me of who they were really close to. One of them was who Keiko would leave the room and let Elvin talk to one-on-one. That was like a real mark of respect. Like, I remember when I came back, like I was on the road with him, but I was also in school. So I did that on and off solidly for about 4 or 5 years, and then I stopped, but I would still come around. I'd still visit them when they came to my city or whatever. And when I came back around with my first book and gave it to them and everything, that was when Keiko was like, I'm gonna leave the two of you alone. And I was like, I'm in, you know?
I had one other last question. Yeah. I was always curious about the intersection of contemporary music and, you know, sort of in Elvin's life and his thoughts and feelings about hip-hop and rock and funk and just, like, sort of all the music sort of outside of, like, the jazz kind of idiom and that sort of thing. Obviously, he appreciated all kinds of music, but I didn't know how vocal he was about it. Sort of like where Miles Davis was, like, always sort of innovating, going in certain directions like that. Right. Like, weird that those contemporary forms of music fall with Elvin's life.
You know, I don't think that Elvin really listened to or cared that much about them, to be honest. I mean, when he was at home, he listened to classical music. When he was on the road, he obviously played what he played. He certainly wasn't hostile to any of it. I did talk to him about hip hop, and he wasn't, you know, crotchety about it. He wasn't dismissive. And there were always young guys in his band who were straddling the fence. Carlos McKinney is a good example. He was producing, you know, for various Jersey hip hop artists. And there were a lot of jazz, young jazz guys who, some of them in a very cynical way, were like doing hip hop on the side on some like, I'm a pedigree jazz musician. I can, you know, I can make beats. It's like, nah, you actually can't. You don't know how to do that. You think you do because you think that it's an inferior form of music, and that's, but you think it's a paycheck, but actually your shit doesn't swing,
right,
ironically enough, you know? I mean, I think Elvin enjoyed all music. I remember one of my fondest and strongest memories of him was we were in a hotel in Nice in France, and it was a real late night. The there was a fashion competition at the hotel. There were all these models staying there. So I was out at the clubs with Carlos McKinney and Greg Williams, who's a bass player, and we were like, I won't even get into all of that, but we came back to the hotel bar at like 2 in the morning maybe with some young ladies, and we were having a drink at the bar, and lo and behold, in walk Elvin and Keiko, up way past their bedtime, you know what I mean? And there was like the bar, they were playing like hip hop, some kind of French hip hop or something, and we all looked up and saw Elvin, and he saw us, and he like danced his way over to the, you know, him and Keiko busted out into like a dance, and we were all like, oh shit, you know, he looked so hip. I mean, he was so smooth. So you know, I think if it moved him, he was open to it. There's a famous story about him having a drum battle with is it John Bonham? Is that the cat?
Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. This is documented in the liner notes to the Impulse Elvin Jones. There's like a 2-record set,
mm-hmm.
if you've ever seen it.
On Impulse.
It's like they did a whole series of them. Like there's an Ahmad Jamal one. They do these 2-record sets, and they're like excerpts from different songs, different albums, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And the liner notes to this detail how Elvin gave an interview to Downbeat, one of those blindfold tests in like 69 or something, and inadvertently disses John Bonham. I'm pretty sure it was John Bonham. Like, they play him some shit, and Elvin's quote is something like, he needs to lose his ass in space because he ain't playing shit, right? And somehow, this got back to Bonham, who I guess was, they were friends? I don't know.
Right.
They end up having this battle in London in some big hall, balcony, standing room only, and Bonham shows up with, you know, like some huge set, some big-ass rock set with 15 different kinds of splash cymbals. Elvin's got the 4-piece joint and blows him the fuck away.
No con.
The end.
Yeah. Rap genius.
I tried to ask him about it one time, and he downplayed, oh, it was for charity or something.
Yeah, he didn't seem like he really would beef that much. He was pretty straight with everybody.
Yeah, no, he was. But, you know, they're also, I mean, as loving as he is and or was, you know, there you could see flashes of the guy he used to be, like the fierce dude that he could be if he got pissed or when he was just in another kind of mind space. Like, I mean, there are crazy stories about him throwing a cymbal at somebody's head, and there's a famous story about him horning in on Pete LaRocca's gig with Sonny Rollins when they're recording live at the Vanguard.
Yeah, sure.
You know that album?
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It was LaRocca's gig, but Elvin just kind of showed up and like gradually muscled the dude off the drum set and like took over the gig. And then Sonny didn't have any money to pay him, and he like chased him down 7th Avenue and like did the old The old pat down.
I know you got something hidden in there.
Yeah.
Don't hold that on me.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. There was something that the piece you wrote after his passing mentioned somewhere, I think maybe just in the author blurb, that there's something about his memoirs.
Yeah, yeah. One of my biggest regrets is that I got a book contract to write Elvin's memoirs with him, like, you know, 6 months before he took ill, and we never even started. So I wish I'd done that 4 years earlier, but I probably wasn't in a position to secure that deal because I wasn't in the game as much. But yeah, I was going to do his memoirs with him.
Well, if, where did things stand? I remember reading that. I remember being like, man, I can't wait for this book to come out. But, so where do things now stand? How does that work out with the legality of sort of passing things on to somebody who would eventually...
I mean, honestly, there's nothing to pass. I mean, there's nothing in writing to pass on. Obviously, as you can hear, I have stories about him. But I got that deal, and almost as soon as it happened, he was ill, and we never even like had conversation the first. So there's another guy whose name escapes me at the moment, but he's a drummer. He's an old friend of Elvin's. He's expressed some desire to do Elvin's biography or whatever. Keiko's expressed some desire to do something as well.
Yeah.
But as far as I know, there's nothing like in the works.
No. Really has come forward. Because Mel Torme did that really great biography about Buddy Rich. That was cool. And then there's different books where it's like a compilation of different people's remembrances and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Oral history kind of thing.
Yeah, that would be a good thing to do. I would even, you know, try to get involved in something like that. I mean, there are so many guys who have played with him who are, you know, still around and still have stories to tell.
Yeah. Wow. I wanted to talk something a little bit about your writing and what I liked about it, which was stuff that's not in but that you leave out of your novels, like in the Elvin Jones-esque character, Albert Van Horn. You never actually see him during his worst sort of junkie periods.
Mm-hmm.
And you never exactly find out, except other than brief, you know, you never find out what happens to Enrage is Back, what happens to Rage, the title character. When he first comes back to New York City, you hear snippets, but you don't exactly know what happens between the sort of thing that makes him kind of black out and when he's first discovered.
Mm-hmm.
How do you decide what to leave out of a story?
I think that I believe in the use of ambiguity as a tool. I think that not filling in all the gaps and all the questions with answers is often the best way to tell a story. I was certainly most conscious of that by far with Rage is Back. I mean, there are big unanswered questions, and I wanted ambiguity and mystery and unresolvability to be almost like a character in the book. You know, we don't ever lay eyes on this demon who may or may not exist.
That was one of the other things I wanted to bring up, is you never know whether the villain is just a villain or a supernatural villain.
Yeah, exactly. And I never even considered, you know, playing it any other way. I never gave any real thought to letting the reader know how Billy got from that hotel room in the Amazon back to the tunnels of New York. I guess for me, partly it's about leaving, not playing every note, you know, leaving some space for the reader to think about these things and try to puzzle them through. It's not that there aren't answers necessarily, but that I'm not willing to draw one answer out of the nimbus that's swirling around of possible answers, possible vectors. And with Rage in particular, with that book, you know, I'm playing with ideas of magic and of realities that are not entirely knowable, and a lot of those things I don't want to categorically resolve one way or another. I want to let them breathe and inhabit this in between space where, yeah.
Awesome. And as someone, as we were talking about before, off air a little bit, we both have lived in Boston in the past. And someone else who lived in Boston who I knew a little bit was Noel Ignatieff, who was the guy behind the journal Race Trader. And so you're in Angry Black White Boy, you have the Race Trader project that takes a the name from his thing, but is obviously fictional and much bigger than his thing ever got. First of all, was your use of Race Trader in that book inspired by the actual journal or project of Race Trader?
It wasn't. I mean, I was aware of that.
Mm-hmm. But you kind of took the name?
I mean, I took the name in the same way that he took the name, in the sense that it's a concept before it's a journal. You know, it's an idea that had been, I think, bandied about, and it was central to the book I was writing. What does it mean to be a race trader? And, you know, I wanted to toy not only with the ideas, but even with the word. And there's a good amount of wordplay in the book. The first book is called Trader. The second is called Trader with a D. And then the last one is called Race. So, I mean, I'm sort of playing variations, so to speak, even on that title. So, I mean, I was dimly aware of the journal, but I don't think I ever read it.
Okay. Yeah, I was curious about that. Like I said, I've been kind of known some of the folks involved in that back in, I think it was really kind of swinging, like the late 90s.
Mm-hmm. And I was in New York by that point.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. And there was something, you talked about something that really struck me, was this idea of, like, as a fan of hip-hop, right, particularly when you started being a fan, it was something that, like, you know, opened your eyes to stuff that maybe you didn't know before. But then there's the thing of thinking that what you do once you're aware of, you know, white supremacy is to not to, I think you said, like, not to attack it, but to somehow get past it personally by your biography, by, like, being accepted and being outside it in some way.
Well, I mean, I think that there's there's often an appetite on the part of white kids who get into hip hop, at least back when I did. I think the landscape is tremendously different now, and it doesn't involve the same kind of awareness. Hip hop is becoming, in some sense, less racialized. It's not anymore a site that forces white participants to become aware of white privilege, of white supremacy, because you're not exceptional. You're not the only white kid on the scene. You might be the only black kid on the scene in a lot of these insular city-by-city hip-hop scenes. But when I got into it, white hip-hop was one of the only sites in American life that dislocated whiteness from its presumed position of centrality and normality, made it subjective, made you have to consider the entire history and legacy of white co-option of black culture. And, you know, if you went to a party, like, people are going to ask you what you were doing there, not even in a hostile way. And you were like, you had to kind of think about that. Like, yeah, what am I doing here? Like, on the widest and deepest levels, what the fuck am I doing here? And I think the pathology for me at that time was not to get away from it, but to try to confront it head on, because I wanted to be seen as exceptional. So, like, I was the kid rocking the Malcolm X hat to those parties and being the only white kid there, so that people would be sure to, like, ask me a bunch, like, what the fuck do you know about Malcolm X? Thank you for asking. You know what I mean? Like, I will now recite a litany of facts about Malcolm so that you will, at the end of it, like, dap me up and tell me that I'm the cool white boy. And I'm like, goddamn right I am. Or what do you do? Which, again, going back to this notion that you had to, hip hop was participatory, be like, I rhyme. Or word, let me hear you spit something. Thank you for asking. Like, again, let me prove myself. And it was this pathology. And you did that over and I might do that 15 times at that party. You know what I mean? But I think that is not the landscape anymore. And what you're talking about is the flip side of that approach, which is to try to jump the fence in terms of privilege so that you're no longer part of the problem and instead part of some unarticulated solution. And these days it's as likely to be done through consumership as anything else. Like, I own a Most Def CD and I went to a Dead Prez show. So I have jumped the fence in terms of privilege. I'm now not part of the hierarchy that is oppressive, but somehow I'm on the other side of it because I've purchased my way there or I've identified my way there.
Yeah, I guess I was curious about this idea of, like, how did you first come to this realization of, like, the problems with being the exceptional white kid in the room, you know, of that kind, you know what I mean?
The problem with it?
The issue of, like, you know, that in terms of, like, ignoring the larger sort of context of like structural racism and all that. That you're using as kind of your out to think that you're, like you're saying, not a part of structural racism anymore because you're the exceptional kid in the room.
If I can interject one
more.
I always think of the line, you can be a black man, lose all your soul, you can be white and cool, but don't crap your role. Which is another word saying, like, to me, like, that the rules can be bent, but at the same time, underneath that is a certain set of rules behind the rules, really, that are, that I don't know that people are conscious of, but it's definitely there. I mean, and for me, I mean, my experience in a different way is probably very similar. In that I was always the one white kid in the room, and depending on the clothes I was wearing and the way my, you know, my beard was cut, like, they would think I was one of a million things. But the reality is I'm a Jewish kid that loves hip hop. So, there's, you could go a million different directions and go on and on forever about this, but that Q-tip line always sticks in my head, because I feel like as much as somebody can, you know, buy a shirt or, you know, do whatever to kind of fit in, I think ultimately what makes hip hop such an incredible sort of arena for this is that you're judged on your skills, really. So, like, if you are exceptional at whatever you do, if you can rhyme, if you can give somebody more information about Malcolm X than they have, then, you know, like, that's what gets you depth. That's what gets you respect. So for me, like, I've been in the room with people where, like, I couldn't possibly come from a more different world than they come from, but they recognize my skills, and therefore I'm cool. And I think that on that level, that's one of the things that makes hip hop so incredible. I mean, whether here or anywhere else around the world, I think it's one of the reasons why people gravitate to hip hop.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with all that. And that was a beautiful thing, that it did always come down to skills, like when everything else was said and done. But, you know, there's also nuances to that. Like, I, you know, there were many times when I got crazy amounts of props as, like, some 15-year-old white kid rhyming, more so than I deserved, because I exceeded the expectations of a white kid rhyming. You know what I'm saying? So there's that. I mean, in terms of thinking about structural racism, I mean, first of all, the music made me do it. You know what I mean? Like, you had to really grapple. If you wanted to be a part of this thing, it's amazing that, you know, it may be amazing to people listening to this right now in 2013 who grew up in a world where hip hop was a dominant cultural art form, to think that you had to track it down and search for it and hunt for it in, you know, neighborhoods that were hard to get to or considered scary by people. And it may be incredibly surprising for a lot of people to know that hip hop plays such an incredible premium on intelligence and on research. Like, you, if you really wanted to, like, be fully a part of this thing, you had to know who Chuck D was talking about when he said, you know, when he threw out Joanne Chesimard's name or Farrakhan's name.
I remember looking up that very line as a kid. Yeah.
Yeah. Nowadays, I don't know what Rick Ross makes you look up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a different landscape. But I mean, being cool, I mean, hip hop made it cool to be smart for a lot of people. Q-Tip made it cool to be that wallflower poet in the room who wasn't, like, the life of the party, who wasn't in the middle of the dance floor, you know, acting crazy, but was, like, playing it low-key. I mean, like, hip-hop did so many things. But, I mean, in terms of seeing that larger scope of structural racism, the music insisted on it. But also, at some point, it, you know, on a self-critical tip, you realize that what you're engaged in with this exceptionalism is a very lonely project, that there's no space for community. I mean, it's something that cats used to joke about, Jeff Chang used to call it white boy syndrome, which is that thing of wanting to be the only exception to the rule, wanting to be the only cool white boy at the party, and, like,
Ross calls it white on white crime when you see another white person in it.
Right, throwing shade. Yeah. I mean, because one of two things were going to happen, right? Either, you know, if I'm at a party and J. Period is also there, circa 1989, you know, we both had to sneak out of our houses to get there because we're well underage. Like, either, you know, and again, this is in a landscape where there's no visible representations of white people in hip hop, or they're very limited. So it's like, you're a Beastie Boy. Nah, really, I'm not. But that's all you got. Then Vanilla Ice comes out, Third Bass comes out, a few more options. But I'm still not one of those. But, like, if I walk into a party and unexpectedly I see J. Period in the spot, it's going to be one of two things. Either he's going to embarrass me and fuck up my project of you can be cool and white and hip hop by being some type of buster, or much worse, he's going to be cooler than me. And now he's the cool white boy at the party, which makes me the buster. But there was a sense that there was only space. You know, that was how you defined yourself, was as being the only one who could be down with this culture, or who was not afraid to be at the whatever party in Roxbury or whatever the fuck it was, you know? So there was this, but at some point I think I realized, like, that's a ridiculous project. Like, being the only, where does that leave you? Like, what do you go home and pat yourself on the back at night because you're the only down white boy in this whole hip hop shit? You know? It's like,
I used to think about it more in terms of just being like an anomaly. And that I enjoyed being an anomaly. I enjoyed not fitting in anywhere, like in a certain way. Like, I could be in a room full of Jews and feel like I'm not like all these people, at the same way that I can be in a room full of black people and feel like a kinship, but I know that I'm not like, you know, I'm not actually like these people. So, like, to me, like, I always looked at it like, I'd rather rewrite the rules. Like, I'd rather create my own set of rules for how I approach this, as opposed to abiding by everyone else's rules. And when I went to school, like when I went to Stanford, that ended up becoming my major. Like, I literally did an individually designed major pulled with bits and pieces of all these different, you know, sources to basically prove this point that I had inside of me, that like the way we talk about this stuff isn't the right way of talking about it, and we need another way of talking about it. And in some weird way, that's kind of become my thing in music. You know, it's the same sort of thing. It's just like, what you guys are doing with mixtapes is some bullshit. Like, you could be doing this over here and just try and fucking push the envelope beyond maybe what it was intended to prove that same point. And that's why I talk about hip-hop the way I talk about it in general, because like, I really do think that it's a vehicle, and a tremendous vehicle, for bringing all these different kinds of people together. I think if you start talking about it like that too much, it becomes corny. Mm. And so, like, you can't really do that. But quietly, you know, like, inside myself, I really believe that. And I've also seen it everywhere I've gone in the world, that hip-hop is this ridiculous thing that brings all these different things together. And even, again, if we're talking about sampling, or the way he writes his books, or the way I make my mixtapes, like, I use as a metaphor hip-hop itself, because to me, like, hip-hop is like, I said this in an interview I just did, but it's like a hybrid mutant genre made up of bits and pieces of all the other genres. It's like a super genre. And so, like, what better, you know, vehicle than that to take things from everywhere and bring them together in a new way that makes sense? Because, like, even the way we sit here and talk about race kind of doesn't really make sense in the way that it made sense 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like, shit is different. And so, like, I think, like, my thing has always been, like, we need a new way of not just talking about it, but, like, some new metaphor, I guess. And for me, in my life, like, that's what hip-hop has become, I guess.
Awesome. Adam, I wanted to jump back to something. You said something about, like, samples, right? Speaking of sampling and recontextualizing. And you said you really liked the party and bullshit, the use of the Last Poets. And somewhere I was reading about that.
Well,
it was like, you like there that, you know, because it totally reversed the intended meaning.
Yeah, I don't know if I liked it exactly. I mean, liked might not be the verb I would use.
Okay.
But I've used that as an example because it's such a profound flip of the original meaning and context.
Yeah, and I wanted to bring it up because when I talked to Avi Odun, Last Poets, who, you know, said that originally, and he's still upset about it.
I bet he is.
Yeah.
He made a song that got turned entirely 180 on its head. He made a song saying, basically, there's not going to be a revolution because motherfuckers are too busy partying and bullshitting. And Biggie took it and made it a hedonistic anthem about partying and bullshitting. If you're not upset by that, you're either a real easygoing cat, which Abby O'Doon is, or you're just not paying attention. So I'm not surprised that he's pissed, you know?
Rap Genius.
It's actually staggering to me that that doesn't happen more often, though. If you actually look at the larger framework of the way that we can trace people's influences by what they sample. I mean, it's funny because, like, there's a paradox there. Like, you know, we love to talk about hip hop as recontextualizing shit, and people flip, you know, samples in all kinds of different ways. The context is totally changed. But the number of times that people have done that and actually flipped something in a way that's antithetical or objectionable to the original context is pretty limited. And I think that shows that cats are actually listening. Like, if you look at all the other ways in the entire discography of hip hop that particularly very political vocalists have been sampled. Let's limit it to Gil Scott-Heron, The Watts Prophets, The Last Poets, Gene McDaniels, you know, like these kind of like 70s spoken wordy political, you know, like that's probably the only example that we can come up with that any of those guys would find objectionable. Everybody else has been sampled in a way that's very much in keeping with their ethos and largely by rappers who were political in their own right, whether it's KRS-One, the government you have elected is inoperative or whatever else. Like, even when it's not vocals that are being sampled from these artists, it's just music. Like the way that, the Last Poets in particular have been sampled by Digable Planets or Tribe Called Quest, like it generally fits in. So, you know, we talk at length and it's right to talk about how we just snatch shit and flip it up and switch it. But like when it comes down to the actual politics of it, shit is pretty consistent. The Watts Stack soundtrack, whatever it might be. Yeah. Right? I mean, am I missing?
No, I agree. I mean, to me, the interesting stories are always the ones about the songs that didn't come out because the original artist wouldn't clear it.
True.
Because of the content.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, definitely. You hear that?
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
Fair enough. You mentioned KRS-One in that last answer. In a lot of your books, like the first 2 to 3 BDP albums are kind of like these touchstones for a lot of the characters. Right? What are your memories of listening to those records?
I'll go the first
four, maybe?
Well, I mean, personally, I'd go deeper than the first four. Wow. I mean, like, Sex and Violence was huge to me. I remember getting that the day it came. I remember getting the Like a Throttle. I remember my man 5 Grand. I remember waiting in my dude 5 Grand, the 5,000 pound man's basement. He got off work and I was in there with my guy C Justice.
Great name, by the way.
Yeah. You know where that's from, right?
No.
The Rashawn Roland Kirk album, Return of the 5,000 pound man.
Okay.
That's where he got that from. I was in 5 Grand's basement with my guy C Justice and 5 Grand came off of work and he had the Like a Throttle, the Duck Down Like a Throttle 12-inch. Mm-hmm. I remember him throwing it on and like fucking the when KRS-One goes into that style halfway through Like a Throttle, like bringing it back, like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. Because when a lyric come, okay, I said just begin. That shit. Yeah, no, those were landmark albums. I mean, each and every one of them, I have stories about discovering each one of them in different ways. You know, Ghetto Music, The Blueprint of Hip Hop, which came out in 89, came out about 2 months late. And I spent my entire fucking summer, every Tuesday, it was Tuesday, right? Records came out on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Every Tuesday, I would go to the fucking record store. And it's like, it's still not out? Are you fucking kidding me? Like, what the fuck? Like, I mean, that's all I did all summer was wait for that album to come out. Like, I have no other memories of that entire summer. You know what I mean? Like, that was it. Yeah. I mean, yeah, no, I mean, it's amazing the way that our memories are keyed into this music. And it's so, you know, I mean, there's so many songs that will bring a welling up of emotion, you know, when I hear them nowadays. And, you know, I mean, we wore those tapes out, you know, like I wore out multiple copies of Criminal Minded. Granted, B-Boy Records was not putting out top quality products, so wearing that shit out might have been... They couldn't even spell the song titles right, so... yeah, I mean, I have so many memories of all of those joints, of memorizing. You know, I mean, and it's funny, too, because the stuff is so deeply embedded. Like, I was in L.A. last week, and I had this exhausting day. I was there to pitch a movie studio on my take on a... is actually to pitch them on my take on my book, which they're trying to make into a movie and need a new writer for. And I'm in there like explaining to them.
You're in the running for it?
Yeah, I'm in the running for it. I probably won't get it either. But I'm like pitching them how I see my book working.
Yeah.
And then afterward, I'm with my boy and we get into a crazy traffic jam, like a 3-hour. It was Valentine's Day. He made me go to Malibu to give his girl flowers. We're coming back and it's like, it's just a shit show. It's a 3-hour bumper to bumper joint. Footnote, he broke up with her 3 days later. Oh. What the fuck? But like, my energy is so low. He's got nothing in the car I want to listen to. So we turn on the radio and they play I'm Bad, the Cool J song. And I hadn't heard that shit in I don't know how many years, you know? And I fucking knew every word of it. I was like I was practically bouncing off the walls while it was playing, and for a half an hour afterward. Like, I would have probably passed out if that song hadn't come on. And instead, I'm going down memory lane, and I'm re-experiencing these lyrics, you know, and remembering what a bad motherfucker Cool J was in '88. That song is a fucking tour de force. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
My vocals exact, like rack and pinion in a jag. You know, like... Yeah, crazy. No good scavenger, catfish, vulture. My rhymes, my rhymes are scalpel and this composition sculpture. I'm bad. That's how the song ends. Like, crazy.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just rambling on.
It's, I mean.
I think I told you I had like a pivotal moment like three weeks ago. I guess it was longer. It was when I was working on the Rage Is Back mixtape.
Yeah.
And trying to sort of find the songs that were from that era that really describe everything I love about hip hop. And the one that I came up on, which I don't know how, because it's my favorite song of all time, but it's the song, the finale song from Beat Street, called Beat Street Breakdown. It's Melly Mel. Mm-hmm. And like my wife has a new appreciation for how much I love that song, because it is a 7-minute song and I literally remember every fucking word of that song from front to back, like every word. And I like, not only can I rap the song, I can do all the hand motions of the cuts. Seriously. And this is before I was ever DJ.
Right.
Yeah. So I memorized it. Like, it's like, yeah man, like, yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them, though, like that. Like, I really, it's funny, like, you talk about, like, Rick Ross lyrics now. Like, I wonder if anyone can recite an entire Rick Ross song. Like, they might remember, like, you know, I feel like Big Meech, Larry Who, you know, like, some little clever bits.
Yeah.
But, like, nobody's obsessed with the lyrics like they were back then. Like, that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's some 14-year-old kid who's in front of his mirror right now doing that shit with a pillow in his under his shirt or whatever. But I mean, it's too much shit in the market now. Like when I did get that ghetto music album, when it finally came out in like late fucking August, you know, like, it's not like it didn't have 50 other albums and mixtapes to compete with. It's like, there was that time when you could be up on everything that came out. Like the era that we came up in, you could, if you had, you know, I got a little allowance, you know, I spent it all on music. And it's like, I remember going to the record store and looking at the tape racks and like being like, I already have everything that's out right now that I know I want. That's like, I know is fresh. I already got, you know, the new Steady B and the new Stetsasonic and the new whatever. And I got 10 bucks left. I'm just going to buy like an album that looks like it might be good, or that has the Stop the Violence logo on it, or some signifier, or, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
you could buy everything that was earmarked for you, that you knew was fly, that you read about in Word Up or the Source or whatever,
yep.
And then still have money left to be like, I wonder what this is, you know? I mean, that era is never coming back.
Yeah. I definitely used to buy based off like label. Like if you would see that Tommy Boy label, like you knew it was something good, like at a certain point in time. Like I used to do that all the time.
Going back to the book, the climactic plan, without giving any away, people who haven't read the book, you know, the way the book ends is, you know, throughout there's this idea of like, how can maybe we can get all the trains in the city at the same time. And that came, I mean, not that that happened in real life, but that was something you got from someone else, right? The idea of doing that.
Well, I mean, I didn't get the idea of doing it, but I got the practical steps that would be required to do it.
Ah.
Because for anybody who's so inclined and has the right resources and so forth, it is doable. The climactic plan in the book involves this elaborate plan to bomb, that is, paint every train in the New York City subway system in one weekend, thus forcing the city to either run painted trains or shut down service. Because the way that it works, you know, quiet as it's kept, people still paint trains in New York City. Those trains seldom run because the policy is to clean them before they can. Occasionally, somebody will hit a train while it's being stored in a layup and it has to run once before it can be cleaned, so you might see that piece one time. Or there's something called back jumps or motioning, which is hitting a train in service, which is something that Europeans are very good at because there are cities where that's the only access to trains they have. So like guys in Copenhagen, you know, mastered that, and like some of them paint ambidextrously, but they can knock out a piece, like a straight up burner.
While the train is moving?
Not while it's moving, but while it's in service, parked for 5-6 minutes at the end of the line. So, like, they, you know, if you take the train all the way to the last stop,
yeah,
it might pause there for right, 5 or 7 minutes. Yeah, they'll clean it during that amount of time. Not while it's actually moving. That would be some next level shit.
Yeah,
But so, wow, the idea is if you paint every train, they can't take them all out of service, so you force them to run bomb trains, which is what they end up trying to do.
Yeah,
I remember taking my friend Ket out to lunch. Ket is the founder of Stress Magazine. He's a very important figure in the graffiti scene. I call him New York's graffiti ambassador in the sense that he actually literally performs the functions that an ambassador would. Like when visiting dignitaries come to the city, he might show them around. When you go to another city, you ask him who to connect with. Like I spent a lot of time in Stockholm. And the first time I went there for an extended period, I was like, Alan, I'm going to Stockholm. He's like, no doubt. Call Jacob, Tobias, boom, boom, boom. You know what I mean? So I took Ket out to lunch and I was like, yo, so, you know, I'm writing this book and how would you, is it possible, could you bomb every train in the system more or less at once? And I knew that Ket's crew, RIS, had actually taken out whole lines in the early 90s after
the
official.
Early
90s. Yeah, yeah. They, RIS, there's a book called Rockin' It Suckers that Ket put out recently that details this period where the war was essentially over. The city had won the buff, et cetera. But RIS was like, fuck that. And they kept hitting trains just on some spiteful, fuck the cops. Nobody's really ever gone harder at like the transit authority and even individual cops than that crew. And so they were still hitting trains and they took out lines sometimes. So anyway, I took him out to lunch. I was like, could you do the whole city? Is it possible? And Ket like looked around. Yeah, basically. Well, he looked around. He's like, yo, B, you know, I've been thinking about this for like 20 years. You know? And he kind of like broke down the elements, what you would need, how you would do it. And, you know, I think Dengue has that line in the book. He says something like when Dondi first brings up the idea, Dengue's like, you know, I have given this some thought. And yeah, and he broke down to me basically a blueprint for how you would do it. And yeah, I mean, give or take the use of like imaginary psychotropic drugs from the rainforest, the way it happens in the book is a pretty reasonable, you know, for anybody out there who wants more information on how to do it. So, you know.
Nice. And just one final thing, and I hope you don't mind talking about it. Obviously, about Go the Fuck to Sleep. Not even anything about the book, but just the hype around it. I was so curious about being, you know, suddenly and presumably unexpectedly
mm-hmm.
thrown into the cultural mainstream, you know, right in the center of it. Like, what
yeah.
was that? You know, in 2 minutes, you know, what was the short version of what that was like?
It's hard to do justice to how crazy the shit really was. And I mean, continues to be on some level. Like, I mean, I'll put it like this. For the first 8 months, I would say, I was doing... Well, the book wasn't supposed to come out until October of 2011. I did a reading in April, so like, whatever, 6 months earlier. And that's when the hype started. The book hit number one on Amazon by the end of April, like without existing. You know what I mean? The book literally did not exist, hadn't even been printed yet. It was number one on Amazon. And the media frenzy was crazy, and we were frantically rushing it out, trying to get it out by Father's Day. And it was just levels. It kept rising and rising. And when I thought things were about to die down, they'd get even crazier, you know, from Sam Jackson doing the audiobook to any number of other forms of just lunacy.
What was your favorite reading of it, by the way?
Sam's is great. Werner Herzog's is great. I'm partial to this Filipina grandmother on YouTube. Actually, in all seriousness, it's been a much watched clip. It's great because it's this woman, this young mother gives the book to her mom to read to her daughter, and without any warning or anything, doesn't tell her what it is. And the woman, she's adorable. She just starts reading it with no idea where it's going, gets to the first curse, and is like, is shocked and titillated and giggling and is like, oh, this is so bad. No, you shouldn't be hearing this, but keeps reading. And every page, it gets funnier and funnier because she's just like continually can't believe what she's reading and is tutting and but also giggling and enjoying it and reading it to her granddaughter. And it's just like, it's adorable. But anyway, during that whole period of time, like I would say literally for 8 solid months, I was doing 8 hours of interviews every single day.
Rap Genius
became my job. I couldn't tell you in retrospect how it's possible to do that many. I don't think I can name, I mean, that's an incredible number of media outlets. But this is like worldwide. It's being translated into 40 languages. We sell the movie rights. You know, I'm pitching I sell a TV pilot kind of based on my life experience with the shit. I mean, it was bananas. And it was constant. It was answering the same questions thousands of times, trying to sound excited about each answer and actually being excited about each answer because the shit is like life changing for me. I mean, you know, that shit will put my kid through whatever type of school she's interested in going to. You know what I mean? Like it was crazy. It was jarring. It was fun, but it was also like really perplexing and weird and unexpected. And I did have this sense to bring it like back to hip hop and back to the work that I actually do. I mean, on one level, Go the Fuck to Sleep is every ounce in line with every other book I've ever written.
So you're funny, you know, in a lot of writing, so it's not out of line.
I mean, the thing that the people who knew me found so great about the whole shit, as my friend, as Andre Willis, who I mentioned before, as my mentor who introduced me to the Marsalises and all of that, he put it best. He was like, what's great about this is you didn't calculate this. This isn't some attempt to get into the mainstream. This is you talking the same type of shit that you've been talking since I met you when you were 14. And it just happens to have hit some crazy ass vein in the zeitgeist. So, you know, yeah, a lot of my books do deal with humor and also honesty. Like the reason that that book works, that it did what it did, is that it is honest about something that there's precious little honesty about. You know, there's not really a conversation about parenthood that acknowledges the difficulties, the tribulations, the paradoxes of it. And that's what I try to do in all my work is deal with paradox, deal with complexity. It might be white privilege and hip hop and that whole matrix. It might be religion and identity and the end of the Jews. It might be the paradoxes running through the lives of graffiti writers, art and anonymity, vandalism and, you know, art and vandalism, fame and anonymity. Or it might be the paradox that you can love your kid to death, but also want to fucking throw that kid out a window after 2 hours trying to put him to bed. So it was very much in line with my work, but I did often have this weird sense of, I don't even quite know how to put it, of being through some type of looking glass where I was in all these spaces that I was like, as if I'd broken in, like the feeling that you would get. I don't know if this is something you guys ever did, but the feeling you would get as a guy who just snuck into a party or a wedding or something, you know, like, right. you go hotel hopping or whatever, and you're like, hey, I got a free drink and I'm at a wedding and I didn't get invited to this shit and maybe I'll get thrown out, but I'm gonna play like I belong here and right. Enjoy how bugged out this is. Like that's kind of how I felt throughout the whole thing.
Feeling like that on daytime television.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when I got booked to go on the Today Show, right? Yeah. I was on there twice. And I remember thinking, I was like, you know, I got the call that they were going to do it because they were really worried. They like vetted me really hard in terms of whether I was going to curse or not. I remember doing all these pre-interviews with producers and they were like, if you say fuck, I will lose my job. And I'm like, I'm not a fucking idiot, you know? And I would mess with them. I'd say shit in the pre-interviews like that. I'd be like, listen, I'm really fucking good at not fucking cursing. I fucking promise you, you know? And they'd be like freaking out. But I'd be like, I remember I remember thinking that maybe I should shut down my little YouTube channel where I'm like giving talks about angry black white boy and getting into like white privilege and the nitty gritty of like, you know, all of this heavy shit. Cause I had this feeling like maybe somebody will Google me and they'll see that I probably in their eyes fall on some crazy radical hip-hoppy end of the political spectrum and they'll just dead the shit. I remember thinking, like, that could happen, you know, maybe. So, yeah, there were a lot of weird moments where you're like, you know, I never intended to be this dude, but I'll fuck it. Like, I can be this dude and then I'll go back to doing the shit that I really do, like writing crazy graffiti revenge novels and shit, you know what I mean?
That was our interview with author Adam Mansbach, with special guest DJ J Period and Dresden Dolls drummer Brian Viglione. If you enjoyed Outside the Lines, you can subscribe to make sure you never miss an episode by visiting us on iTunes. While you're there, review the show. The more positive reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get quality guests like Adam Mansbach. Hit me up with your thoughts about Outside the Lines via Twitter. I'm at Same Old Sean. That's S-H-A-W-N. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is created and written by Sean Sotero, a.k.a. Same Old Sean.
But the reality is, I'm a Jewish kid that loves hip-hop.
The podcast is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Sonny didn't have any money to pay him, and he, like, chased him down 7th Avenue and, like, did the old pat-down.
This interview was recorded by Sean Sotero. Our show's loyal intern is Sonny Kahara.
You think it's a paycheck, but actually your shit doesn't swing.
Our music is by Psionic.
Yeah.
He's a beast.
And the webmaster of the upcoming OutsideTheLinesPodcast.com is Paul Dice.
It's still not out? Are you fucking kidding me?
Join us next week when we talk to Mr. Len, who, along with LP and Big Juss, formed the legendary underground rap group Company Flow.
Like, what the fuck do you know about Malcolm X? Thank you for asking.
I'm now ready.
A litany of facts about Malcolm so that you will, at the end of it, like, dap me up and tell me that I'm
word.